Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. This is going to be an unusual podcast for Jazz on the Tube. I'm going to read from a book, and I would love to interview the author. The author is Tom Stoddard. Trying to find out if he is available for an interview. If anybody knows, I would love to hear from them. I'm not able to find him easily on the internet. Don't know what that means. But anyway, this we're going to be reading from his book. It's called Jazz on the Barbary Coast. And there's a introduction to this book by Douglas Henry Daniels. And we had a great interview with Professor Daniels years ago about his work, and he pointed something out in that interview which has been reinforced by the interview we did with Dave Oliphant on Texas jazz, that jazz did not originate in one place and spread to the rest of the country. I know that's a nice, easy story to wrap your mind around, and with all due respect to my friends in New Orleans, it's a very profitable story for them, and I still think everybody should go to New Orleans and enjoy it and participate in the culture there. However, it's just simply not true that jazz started in New Orleans and spread out to the rest of the country from there. And that's what we're going to be talking about and reading from this book to reinforce that reality. We always want to go with the simple narrative. It's just simpler. Life's complicated, and if somebody can give us a simple, easy story, it makes life easier. Years ago, and this would have been 1981, I was doing a school project, and I was one of the rare people in those times to do academic work in jazz history. And one of the things I did for my project, my senior project, was I got a map of the United States, and I made a list of about 200 jazz musicians, and I got pins, and I stuck the pins in the cities they were born. And I had a friend at the time who, if anybody knows who this guy is, please tell him to contact me. I can't find him. Neil Carton, New York City. And Neil, who was a serious jazz student. I mean, he's the kind of guy, literally, you could pull a random record off the racks, put it on the turntable, drop the needle anywhere, and he'd tell you not just who the tune was, not just who the musicians were, but when it was recorded and where. He really knew the music. And he wasn't a snob about it. He just loved it, and he knew it. Anyway, Neil came to my little senior exhibition and looked at my map and said, "Wow, I've never seen that before." And here it is, 2019. I don't think you've ever seen it since. So if you listen to our interview with Professor Daniels, it's one of the podcasts. If you listen to our interview with Dave Oliphant, you're going to realize that the talent and creativity and ingenuity and dedication and passion for creating great music existed throughout the country, throughout all the Afro-American communities wasn't just New Orleans. And there were Afro-Americans everywhere, by the way, not just in the South. Surprising number moved to places like North Dakota and Minnesota. In fact, I was alerted to that by reading the wonderful biography by Maxine Gordon of her husband, Dexter Gordon. He's descended from guys, from a guy that made his way somehow to North Dakota. So there were Afro-Americans everywhere in this country, and they were active in music everywhere. And interestingly enough, one of the places they were super active that gets no credit in the history of the development of jazz is San Francisco. Now, everybody's aware of, hopefully, Fillmore Street and all that that took place during and after World War II, and what a great jazz center that was. And people are somewhat aware of that. And of course, they're aware of the current scene in San Francisco and the Bay Area, which is fantastic. But I think very few jazz fans are aware of the fact that San Francisco was not just a place that had some jazz. San Francisco, one of the many root places that contributed mightily to the creation of jazz. So, having not been able to find Mr. Stoddard, I'm just going to read from his book. It's called Jazz on the Barbary Coast. The Barbary Coast was one of those places that just doesn't really exist anymore in America, maybe for the better, a really sleazy, dangerous, harsh place with lots of rot gut bars and, you know, prostitutes working under horrible conditions, but a lot of music, a lot of entertainment music, and it provided work for musicians. And it was called the Barbary Coast, and that was wiped out, you know, nearly 100 years ago. Getting on 100 years pretty soon. But anyway, that's where the Barbary Coast in the title, Jazz on the Barbary Coast, comes from. So let's dive in here. New Orleans is the city most often mentioned in connection with jazz and is the almost sacrosanct birthplace of this unique music. There are a number of components of jazz, though, and surprisingly few of them are connected with the Crescent City. Ragtime is connected with Sedalia and St. Louis, Missouri. Rural blues are linked with backwoods Mississippi and Alabama, and I'm going to throw in eastern Texas, too. City blues are frequently associated with Memphis, Chicago, and New York. Improvisational music has been connected with almost every folk music from hillbilly to flamenco, and some of our early references indicate a freewheeling, improvisational style of playing in the West. That would be California, Nevada, and other places. Polyrhythmic music can be more easily found in Cuba and the West Indies than in any American city. San Francisco can easily claim a closer link with jazz dance than almost any other place. The point here is that perhaps early researchers were too myopic in their investigation of jazz origins. I have long held the notion that black people in America and black music, such as jazz, were so widely scattered that it makes little sense to try to pinpoint the music's geographical origin, much less, as some researchers have done, to try to identify a particular person like Buddy Bolden or Jelly Roll Morton as the source of the music. Rather, it is more likely the music was as widespread as blacks were, and the development of jazz took place over many years in different places and involved many people. When black musicians traveled from one place to another, they were easily accepted by other blacks as playing their music of the times, whether blues, ragtime, or jazz. Certainly there were differences in geographical styles, and there were a number of recognized great performers. Among these early greats were Joe Oliver and Freddie Keppard. And a legend has been made out of the recognition they received when they went to Chicago. Early researchers often cited this recognition as proof that Chicagoans had never heard jazz before. Two factors refute this interpretation. One, Keppard and Oliver were recognized as stars in New Orleans, and it is natural they would be accorded the same sort of recognition in Chicago. Two, their appearances in Chicago began one of the first instances of adulation by white youngsters who spread their fame far beyond the black community. The same sort of recognition was accorded to two other New Orleans giants, Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton, who exerted an even greater impact on early jazz. In my opinion, New Orleans had more active black musicians than any other city, and therefore engendered more of the great exponents of jazz than any other place. Just a little sidebar, no one's disputing the importance of New Orleans. We're just saying the music was going on in a lot of places. It's just New Orleans, because they were the biggest population, generated the most talented people, or many highly talented people, and it makes sense that a lot of the great musicians would have come out of New Orleans, but that doesn't mean the music was founded and originated in New Orleans. It is not my purpose in these short remarks to attempt to change jazz history or to claim that jazz originated somewhere other than New Orleans. It is rather to point out that early research focused very narrowly on New Orleans to the great loss of places like San Francisco, Detroit, Cleveland, Denver, Chicago, Kansas City, Oklahoma City, Seattle, Houston, New York, Washington, D.C., and San Antonio, to name a few of the more promising areas. When researchers did begin investigating an area like California, they rounded up all the old New Orleans expatriates, recorded their playing, and interviewed them. Let me hastily add that I have done the same because of my love for New Orleans jazz. At this point, however, much of jazz history outside New Orleans has been lost, and most of it will never be recovered. It is important to preserve what we can. And I certainly hope in 2019 it's not too late. The text of this book relating to Sid Leprati, Wesley Fields, and Reb Spikes, and the research references quoted, prove conclusively, in my eyes, that there was black jazz being played in the Bay Area by indigenous musicians prior to 1907. The creation of New Orleans jazz is usually dated to the late 90s or the turn of the century. When Will Johnson's Creole Orchestra came to the Bay Area, there were several things Sid Leprati, San Franciscan, noticed about them. The first, and by far the most important, was the four-beat rhythm. This unique feature caused Leprati to change the rhythm of his band and eventually caused the firing of his drummer. This feature is also cited by most jazz commentators as a unique feature of New Orleans jazz. The second was the excellent tunes, which Leprati can't remember. This leads me to conclude they weren't that exciting as tunes, and that his reaction was probably more related to their rhythmic propulsion. Third was their use of pizzicato bass. Reb Spikes did not find anything, he's a San Franciscan, particularly remarkable about New Orleans jazzmen. It is evident that Leprati and Spikes were both admirers of a number of New Orleans jazzmen, particularly Jelly Roll Morton. who Spikes clearly considers the greatest piano player who ever lived. So, yes, there were individual musicians out of New Orleans who were incredibly impressive, but New Orleans in general was not seen as something massively superior. They did recognize the beat. They did recognize the value of the pizzicato bass. But I think what Stoddard is getting at here is the musicality and the ability of musicians in the Bay Area was not insufficient or deficient in any way. Now, when somebody great like Jelly Roll Morton came through town, well, you had to pay attention. But in general, there was nothing that made the musicians of New Orleans greater than the musicians of San Francisco, way back at the early times of the roots of the music. The improvisational component of jazz follows two major trends, collective and solo. Collective improvisation, in which the rhythm section lays down the beat and everyone else improvises at the same time, is closely identified with New Orleans. There was probably no other type of improvisation in New Orleans until after 1920. The collective style of improvisation is credited with having a greater cumulative impact and with being closer to the African roots of jazz. In solo improvisation, one member of the band improvises over a rhythmic foundation and or over a diminished counter melody by another member of the band. We actually talked about this a little bit in our interview with Vic Hobson about Louis Armstrong. This style of improvisation has not been linked with any geographical school of jazz. Okay, so sidebar here, collective improvisation, clearly New Orleans. Solo improvisation, clearly Louis Armstrong was one of the pioneers of that kind of music in New Orleans. However, it cannot be said that that was invented in New Orleans. It might have been brought to a very high level by Louis Armstrong in New Orleans, but it can't be said that it was invented there. In fact, it may have been invented somewhere else. So let's go on. Paul Tammany has stated that this style was first introduced in the music of Art Hickman and Paul Whiteman. Whiteman started his career as a member of the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, which he soon left to join Hickman. Hickman was the first popular jazz leader to employ only reading musicians. We have already noted his early connection with jazz. With reading musicians, it is easier to create the foundation or background music for a solo improvisation. Hickman's early bands are reported to have used and probably originated the solo style of jazz improvisation. That's quite a claim there. Whiteman went on to use this style with great success and became world famous as the self-proclaimed king of jazz. The musicians who played and soloed with Whiteman are a who's who of early white jazzmen. They include Bix Beiderbecke, Red Nichols, Jimmy Dorsey, Tommy Dorsey, Hoagy Carmichael, Frank Trumbauer, Joe Venuti, Eddie Lang, Jack Teagarden, and as an arranger, Ferd Grof. The solo style of improvisation has been the dominant style of jazz for the past 40 years. This book was written a while ago, obviously. It is possible that, like other innovative musical ideas of Art Hickman, the solo style of improvising originated with black musicians of the Barbary Coast. And the Barbary Coast, we're talking about the entertainment district of old San Francisco. Reb Spikes clearly identifies Slocum Mitchell as soloing over the counter melodies of Reb's sax and Clarence Williams' bass. Presumably, Sid Liprati and Gerald Wells also took solos. Buddy Mitchell, the cornet player, could have been another early soloist. All right, these are names you probably don't recognize, I certainly didn't recognize them. I only learned these names by reading the book Jazz on the Barbary Coast. But the point that is made in this book, it's a wonderful book. Stoddard goes through and he interviewed many of the old players whose memories date back before the 1920s. And he's found a lot of photographs, and he's found a lot of playbills, and he's read a lot of the old newspapers. And it appears that the word jazz was created in San Francisco. That seems to be indisputable at this point. So this whole mythology that jazz is some kind of African word, that it means sex and all this kind of stuff, is nonsense. The first use of it in print took place in San Francisco, and it's referring to liveliness, life, light, energy, and the old-fashioned word pep, which is a pretty good term to explain what jazz brings to the world. Energy, light. Now, interestingly enough, he found a newspaper article from 1882. That's way back, right? That's, that would be the earliest. If jazz was around, that would have been the earliest time. And it's a reviewer in the San Francisco Argonaut reviewing a show at the Standard Theater on May 1st, 1882. And the group that this reviewer is reviewing is Charles Callender's Minstrels. And it is a black group. And it was created for people that were tired of white minstrels. And so again, the group was called Charles Callender's Minstrels. Now they came to San Francisco in 1882, direct from New York. That's the quote. And here's what this reviewer said. First of all, they're black musicians. Of course, and here's what's so interesting. Of course, they opened with the serious music, which has come to be known as Negro melody. And it was only now and then they drifted into the swinging rhythm, which characterizes their own. Swinging rhythm. 1882, black musicians in San Francisco visiting from New York. Let me just repeat that. Swinging rhythm. This is the language that this reviewer used, which characterizes their own. So the writer in 1882 is saying, this is the music black people are famous for. It's characteristic of their playing. It swings. The rhythm swings. And this was written not in the 1930s, not in the 1920s, not in, the 19-teens in New Orleans. This was written in 1882 about a performance in San Francisco by a band that came out of New York. Oh, how I wish we could hear that music. But it's a clue. It's a clue. And what's all this about? I think we have to look, rather than say jazz came from a few geniuses who lived in the great city of New Orleans. They were geniuses. New Orleans is a great city. Jazz is a cultural product of the Afro-American genius for survival and creativity and innovation. And that survival and creativity and innovation was taking place all over the country in all kinds of guises. One of them happened to be music. And in music, which was really the only profession open to Afro-Americans in those days, there were occasionally Afro-Americans that were able to penetrate the professions, you know, doctors, attorneys, and so on. But it was for the average person, those openings simply weren't available. So the one profession that was open was music. So that's where a lot of the genius and innovation poured into. And, you know, here we are all these years later, and the world is still dancing to the music that group of people created. And it was a nationwide phenomenon. And it came from every place where Afro-Americans could be found. So it's not as easy a story to tell, but it's a more accurate story. I think ultimately it's a more empowering story. You know, this is not about a handful of geniuses. This is about a community and social structure and a people who created something beautiful that we're all still working on and developing, you know, over 100 years later. So the book is Jazz on the Barbary Coast. It's a very unique book because he's talking with musicians that never became famous. You know, they were never recorded. They didn't tour. They stayed home and they played, and they lived off the local gigs. And of course, there were a lot of live music gigs pre-radio, you know, when records were still pretty rare and expensive. There was a lot more work. And it just talks about the kind of gigs that were around, the kind of music venues that were. They weren't all whorehouses. There were, you know, parties and dances and picnics and parades and church events and all kinds of things. So there was a whole lot of live music. There was a whole lot of opportunity for live musicians to play. And so you read and hear about the lives of these musicians, some of whom were great in their own right. But as I pointed out in previous podcasts, being a great musician and being a famous musician are two completely different things. It requires a promotional machine, you know, record labels, radio stations, concert tours, jazz journalists, when you're gone, jazz historians, to make you famous. And if that mechanism isn't lined up in your favor, nobody will ever have heard of you. That's just the fact of life. So there have been a lot of great musicians that we don't know. And to bring this to an end, there's probably a lot of great musicians right in your community that you don't know, which is why we encourage everybody to plug into their local jazz community and step out. You don't have to come to New York City to hear jazz. Nice to go. It's fun. I recommend everybody go to New Orleans. You just have to. But you don't have to go to New Orleans to hear great music. There's probably great music in your backyard, wherever you are. You might have to do a little work to find it. And then once you find it, it's like a thread. You pull on it, and you'll find the whole coat. So the book is Jazz on the Barbary Coast, wonderful biographies, recollections of musicians from the Bay Area, and beautiful photographs. And the photographs tell it all. I mean, you see bands from 1915 that look as hip as they can be, you know, and they're clearly jazz bands. And great, great photographs. Anyway, I could go on and on about this book, Jazz on the Barbary Coast by Tom Stoddard. If anybody knows how to reach Mr. Stoddard, I'd love to interview him directly. If anybody is in contact with Professor Daniels, I've reached out so many times. I really want to interview him on his book about the Oklahoma City jazz scene, which gave birth to the Blue Devils, which is one of the great jazz units of all time. And his book is fantastic as well, especially in how it documents. The social structure and the social institutions and the community institutions and the community support that existed in Oklahoma City and in cities throughout the country for black music. This is a missing part of the history. Professor Daniels tells it as well or better than anybody, and it's something that we should pay attention to. So if anybody knows Dr. Daniels, tell him I'd love to, if it's convenient for him. I'd love to interview him again and get into this subject of the real roots of jazz. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.